He walked slowly around the cellar, making sure he wasn't missing anything significant. He checked the floor, the concrete block walls, the spaces between the joists above his head. He found nothing unusual other than the remarkable orderliness of the place and the absence of dust. When he came to one end of the stack of studs, he noted that it was 12 studs high by 12 deep. The ends on that side were aligned perfectly with each other, no stud even a millimeter out of place. It occurred to him that such an obsessive concern for symmetry could be the basis of a clinical diagnosis. As he was moving past the perfect 8-foot-long stack, however, his eye was caught by an irregular shadow at its opposite end. He stopped, aimed his beam of light across that end of the stack, and saw that one stud was sticking out about a quarter of an inch, noticeable only because of the faultless alignment of the others. It seemed unlikely that a factory-cut stud could have emerged from the process a quarter inch longer than others in the same batch. He laid his phone flashlight on a stair tread, the beam aimed at the stack. He began to disassemble the stack one row at a time. When he reached the level of the protruding stud, he felt, for the second time since he'd become involved in the case, an unmistakable frisson. The center sections of 4 studs in the middle of the stack had been cut away, leaving only about 2 feet at each end. The result was a concealed compartment, 2 studs wide, 2 studs deep, and 4 feet long. The ends of the cut studs had been lined up with the ends of the intact studs, with the exception of that one stud end that stuck out. He saw the reason for it. The end was kept from being aligned with its neighbors by the contents of the hidden compartment. A classic Winchester Model 70 bolt-action rifle, emitting the distinctive odor of a recently fired weapon, a red-dot laser scope, a muzzle blast suppressor, and a box of 30-06 full metal jacket cartridges. Gurney gingerly made his way back up the stairs. As he stepped up through the open trap door into the main room of the cabin, Hardwick came in the front door. In the pale light, Gurney could see that he'd removed the sunglasses, hat, and scarf that were supposed to be hiding his identity from possible security cameras.
"No need for that ski mask," he said to Gurney. "We've got what we need to go public. You found something?" "A used branding iron." He inserted a small dramatic pause. "How do I know it was used? Because there appears to be burned skin stuck to the letters on the end of it. The letters, by the way, are KRS. Jesus. That's not all. There's also a red motocross bike, like the one that was seen zipping away from Poulter Street. You find anything in here?"
"A rifle, probably the rifle, hidden in a pile of lumber in the cellar."
"Is it possible we've got these evil bastards by the balls?"
Hardwick's innate skepticism appeared to be battling with the satisfaction of a successful hunt. He looked around suspiciously, his flashlight beam stopping at the loft.
"What's up there?"
"Let's find out." Gurney led the way up the ladder and stepped into an open-ended room above the kitchen. The underside of the steeply pitched roof was paneled with pine boards, and their distinctive scent was strong. There were 2 beds, one on each side of the space, made up in crisp military style. There was a low bench at the foot of each and a rectangular rug on the floor between them. The loft reflected the obsessive orderliness apparent everywhere in the cabin, all straight lines, right angles, and not a speck of dirt. Gurney began checking one of the beds and Hardwick the other. Feeling under the mattress, he soon came upon something cold, smooth, and metallic. He lifted the mattress out of the way, revealing a slim notebook-style computer. Almost simultaneously, Hardwick pointed to a cell phone taped to the bottom of the footboard of the other bed.
"Leave everything where it is," said Gurney. "We need to call this in, get an evidence team out here." "Who are you going to call it into?"
"The DA. Klein can get Torres reassigned to him on a temporary basis, along with the evidence techs, but that'll be his call. The key thing going forward will be for the investigation and the personnel working on it to be controlled by an agency outside the WRPD.
Another option would be the sheriff's department."
The thought of Goodson Clouts gave Gurney a touch of nausea.
"I'd vote for Klein."
Hardwick's icy grin appeared.
"Sheridan will have a hard time with this, having been such a huge fan of Beckert. Gonna be tough for him to see the big shit getting sucked down the drain. How you think he's going to deal with that? We'll find out.
Hardwick's eyes narrowed.
You think the little creep will try to pull off an end run around the branding iron and rifle to keep from admitting he was wrong? We'll find out.
Gurney switched his phone from flashlight to call mode. In the middle of entering Klein's number, he was stopped cold by a burst of canine howling and snarling. It sounded like a crazed pack of what, wolves? Coyotes? Whatever they were, there were a lot of them. They were in full attack mode, and they were coming closer. In a matter of seconds, the chilling sound had reached a wild intensity, and it seemed to be concentrated directly in front of the cabin. The frenzy of the sound was raising goose flesh on Gurney's arms. He and Hardwick reached for their weapons in unison, flicked off the safeties, and moved to the open edge of the loft where they had clear lines of sight down to the windows and door. A high-pitched whistling sound pierced the din, and as suddenly as the savage uproar began, it stopped. Cautiously they descended the ladder, Gurney first. He moved quietly to the front of the cabin and peered out through one of the windows. At first he saw nothing but the dark, drooping shapes of the hemlocks surrounding the clearing. The grass, which in the beam of his phone light had been a deep green, was in the dawn mist a featureless gray. But not entirely featureless. He noted a patch of darker gray, perhaps 30 feet out from the window. He switched his phone back to flashlight mode, but its beam only created a glare in the fog. He gradually eased the front door open. All he could hear was the slow dripping of water from the roof.
"The fuck are you doing?"
whispered Hardwick. "Cover me and hold the door open in case I need to come back in a hurry." He stepped quietly out of the cabin, Beretta in a ready-to-fire two-handed grip, and advanced toward the dark shape on the ground. As he drew nearer, he realized he was looking at a body that was somehow contorted, twisted into an odd position as if it had been thrown there by a violent gust of wind. After moving a few steps closer, he stopped, amazed by the amount of blood glistening in the wet grass. Still closer, he could see that much of the clothing on the body was shredded, exposing ripped and gouged flesh. The left hand was mangled, the fingers crushed together. The right hand was missing, the wrist a grisly red stump with splintered bones sticking out of it. The victim's throat had been lacerated, the carotid arteries and windpipe literally torn to pieces. Less than half of the face was intact, giving it a hideous expression. But there was something familiar about that face, and the muscular bulk of the body. Gurney realized with a start that he was looking at what was left of Judd Turlock. 4. The Horror Show. 44. 24 hours after the discovery of the gruesome homicide at the cabin, Gurney was heading into the county office building for an early morning meeting with Sheridan Klein. The ponderous red brick exterior, coated with a century of soot and grime, dated back to the structure's original use as a mental facility, the Bumblebee Lunatic Asylum, named after its eccentric founder, George Bumblebee. In the mid-60s, the interior of the structure had been gutted, redesigned, and repurposed to house the local bureaucracy. Cynics enjoyed pointing out that the building's history made it an ideal home for its current inhabitants. The lobby security system had been upgraded since Gurney's last visit, during the harrowing case of the bride who'd been decapitated at her wedding reception. It now involved 2 separate electronic screenings and the presentation of multiple forms of identification. He was eventually directed to follow a series of signs that brought him to a frosted glass door bearing the words, District Attorney. He wondered which version of Klein he'd be meeting with. Would it be the baffled, disbelieving, nearly speechless man he'd encountered on the phone the previous morning when he'd called to tell him about the discovery of the rifle, the branding iron, the red motorcycle, and Turlock's mauled body? Or would it be the man who showed up an hour later at the scene with Mark Torres, Bobby Bascom, Garrett Felder, Shelby Towns, and Paul Aziz, hell-bent to demonstrate his decisiveness by issuing nonstop orders to people who knew far more about processing crime scenes than he did? Gurney opened the door and walked into the reception room. Klein's alluring assistant, who had clearly maintained her fondness for form-fitting cashmere sweaters, eyed him with a subtle smile. I'll let him know you're here, she said in her memorably soft voice. As she was about to pick up her phone, a door in the back wall of the reception room opened and Sheridan Klein came striding over to Gurney, hand outstretched with that same semblance of warmth Gurney remembered from their first meeting years earlier. David, right on time. I'm always impressed by punctuality. He led the way into his office. Coffee or tea? Coffee. He clicked his tongue approvingly. You a dog man or a cat man? Dog. I thought so. Dog people prefer coffee. Cat people like tea. Herbal tea. Ever notice that? It wasn't a question. He turned to the door and called out, Two coffees, Ellen. He pointed Gurney toward the familiar leather sofa while he sat in the leather armchair across from it, a glass coffee table between them. Gurney was for the moment absorbed in the déjà vu experience not only of the seating arrangement, but of Klein's comments on punctuality and the dog-coffee-cat-tea associations. The man had made exactly the same observations when they'd met during the Mellory case. Perhaps he was trying to reset their relationship to an earlier, more positive status. Or maybe these were things he said so often he had no idea to whom he'd said them before. He leaned forward with what could be mistaken for companionable intensity. That was really something yesterday. Gurney nodded. God-awful homicide. Yes. Plus evidence connected to all the murders. What a shock. Yes. Hope you didn't mind my asking you to leave the scene after you got us oriented. Gurney had seen it as a sign of Klein's annoyance at the fact that the people reporting to him were addressing their questions to Gurney and Hardwick. The thing was, explained Klein awkwardly, with Hardwick not having official LEO status, there could have been issues down the road about crime scene protocol. No problem. Good. We've received some more information, amplifying what you'd already found. An overnight ballistics comparison connected the rifle in Beckert's cellar to the Steele and Loomis shootings, as well as to the incident in your backyard. Klein paused. You don't seem surprised. I'm not. Well, there's more. Thrasher did a prelim autopsy on Turlock's remains. Guess what he found? A steel arrow buried in his back? Thrasher told you? No. Then how? When I was still inside the cabin, I heard the dogs coming. Probably from a point in the woods near the edge of the clearing, about 100 yards away. Turlock would have heard them too, but he never fired a shot. In fact, his Glock was still holstered. That makes no sense unless he was already incapacitated when the dogs started coming. And the Gort brothers seemed to be awfully good with those crossbows. Klein stared at him. There's no doubt in your mind it was them? I don't know of any other homicidal crossbow experts around here with a large pack of attack dogs and a major murder motive. The motive being revenge for Turlock's raid on their compound? That, and for publicly blaming them for the BDA murders. Gurney paused. That gives us means and motive. Opportunity isn't quite so obvious. It would depend on the Gorts knowing that Turlock was going to show up at that cabin when he did. That's a big issue. So you're not quite to home base. I'm aware of that. You have Beckert in custody yet? We're working on it. Currently, he's nowhere to be found. Which brings me to the main point of this conversation. Klein paused, sat back in his chair, and steepled his fingers in front of his chin. Your discoveries, for which you deserve tremendous credit, have turned the case around 180 degrees from the way we all saw it. Gurney calmly pointed out that from the beginning he'd been uneasy with the way everyone saw it, that he'd raised objections, and that Klein had essentially fired him for not embracing the official version. Klein looked pained. That seems a little oversimplified. But the last thing I want to do now is debate what's behind us, especially considering the challenge in front of us. We've had more upheaval in the past 24 hours than I've ever seen in any case any time. So far we've managed to keep a lid on what's going to be an explosive story, but that won't last. The facts will come out. We'll have to do our best to present them in a positive way, keep control of the narrative, maintain public trust in law enforcement. I assume you agree? More or less. Klein blinked at Gurney's less than enthusiastic response, but continued along his path. Handled correctly, this huge mess can be positioned as a law enforcement triumph. The message we have to convey is that nobody is above the law, that we follow without fear or favor wherever the truth leads us.
That was Beckert's message before he ended up on the wrong end of it. That doesn't mean it was the wrong message. Gurney smiled. Just the wrong messenger? In hindsight, obviously, but that's not my point. The problem now is that everything's upside down. Could be viewed by the media as chaos. We need to convey the opposite. We need to convey stability. The message is that law enforcement is still operating on an even keel. The public needs to see stability, continuity, competence. I agree. Stability, continuity, and competence are the three keys to keeping external conditions from sinking the ship. But here's the thing. These qualities by themselves are just words. They need life. And you're a big part of that life. Klein was leaning forward now. He seemed to be drawing energy and conviction from his own statements. David, you've been pursuing the truth from the start like a heat-seeking missile. And because of you, we're practically there. I don't think I exaggerate when I say that this could be the single greatest triumph of your law enforcement career. Best of all, it would be a triumph for law enforcement itself, for the rule of law. And that's what it's all about, right? The moment he fell silent, his attractive assistant entered the room carrying a black lacquered tray with a silver coffee pot, two cups, and a china creamer and sugar bowl, and set it all down on the glass coffee table. When she left, Gurney refocused. What do you want from me, Sheridan? I just want to know I can count on your continuing insights and advice to help bring this ship into port. Gurney pondered his apparent transformation from heat-seeking missile to harbor pilot, as well as Klein's endless capacity for duplicity. You want me to stay involved in the investigation? In wrapping up the loose ends, pulling it all together? Continuity. When Gurney didn't respond, Klein added, On your own terms. Freedom to follow the loose ends wherever they lead, without interference. Klein bridled for a moment at that last word, but then emitted a sigh of resignation. We need some clarity regarding the motivation for each of the four homicides, plus Turlock's. We need to know specifically who did what, and we need to find the Gorts. You can follow any of those trails however you want. I'll have full access to Torres, Felder, Thrasher, lab personnel, ballistics, etc. No problem. Klein eyed him anxiously. So, you'll do it? Gurney didn't reply right away. He asked himself yet again why he was doing what he was doing. The virtuous answers, of course, were simple. He was seeing the case through to its conclusion because of his commitment to the wives of the murdered officers, and because the deaths of Jordan and Tooker deserved every bit as much of his attention as those of Steele and Loomis. And because the solution of these murders, along with Turlock's, might lead to the exposure of underlying patterns of corruption. And because bringing closure to so many open wounds might bring a modicum of peace to White River. These motives were real, and they were powerful. But he knew there was also something driving him forward that was less altruistic. Something in the wiring of his brain. A relentless desire to know. To figure things out. It had been his driving force throughout his career, perhaps throughout his life. He really had no choice. Have Mark Torres call me. Gurney wasn't even a third of the way back to Walnut Crossing when he got Torres's call. The DA asked me to provide you with any information you want, especially the stuff that came to light after you left the site yesterday. Is this a good time? Gurney saw that he was approaching Snook's nursery and figured it would be a convenient place to stop. Yes, this is a good time. He pulled into the long, narrow parking lot in front of the greenhouses. How late were you there? All day, all night. Garrett and Shelby set up their halogens and worked until dawn. Tell me about it. Well, first Paul Aziz photographed the whole site, then Turlock's body, then each piece of evidence before it was bagged and labeled. Most of the items were found in and around the shed where your guy Hardwick found the branding iron. There were two sets of clothes buried behind the shed with bloodstains that matched the positions of abrasions on Jordan's and Tooker's bodies. Inside the shed there was a coil of rope that matches the rope segment recovered from the Gortz compound, which seems to link Beckert and Turlock to the playground murders as well as an attempt to frame the Gorts for it. There were bloodstains on the back seat of the UTV. Thrasher did a quick field test on the blood types, and they matched those of Jordan and Tooker.
Any fingerprints on the UTV steering wheel?
Old, smudged, not useful.
How about on the hand grips of the Yamaha bike?
Same. But Beckert's prints appear in various other places on the UTV, and Turlock's appear on the bike's gas cap, which you'd expect, with the UTV being registered to Beckert and the bike to Turlock. And speaking of prints, this morning we finally got a reply from Aphis on that pen you found in the yard behind the Poulter Street house. The print on it is definitely Turlock's.
That's quite a pile of evidence.
There's more. In a fire pit in the woods in back of the shed, we found burned pieces of a baseball bat and nightstick, the likely weapons used on Jordan and Tooker, plus two hypodermic needles of the preloaded type.
Used?
Used and tossed in the fire with the bat and nightstick. But the labeling on one needle didn't burn completely. Enough was left for Thrasher to tell it was propofol.
So the evidence pile keeps growing.
And there's more. Remember at your house the other night, Garrett said your power line had been severed by some sort of cable cutter? We found one under loose floorboards in the shed.
Quite a productive evening.
And I haven't even mentioned the most interesting find, a pair of pliers that prove you were right.
Torres inserted a dramatic pause. Gurney hated dramatic pauses.
What are you talking about?
There was a small toolkit under the sink in the cabin. Garrett thinks the pliers and the kit made the marks on the switched toilet handles. He's having the lab do a comparison to be sure, but he tends to be right about stuff like that.
Gurney felt the satisfaction of being on the right track.
Anything else?
Maybe, maybe not. That notebook computer and the phone you found in the cabin loft, they were password protected, but we sent them to the forensic computer lab in Albany, and we hope to hear something back from them later this week.
This all sounds like a prosecutor's dream.
Do we know yet why Turlock showed up at the cabin when he did?
We think so. There were two battery-operated silent alarm systems, motion-activated, one in the cabin, one in the shed. They were programmed to contact certain phone numbers, presumably Turlock's being one of them, which would explain why he showed up. Garrett was having trouble with a privacy code protecting the numbers, so we sent the devices to Albany along with the phone and computer.
Any leads on locating Beckert?
Not yet. His cell phone's apparently been turned off. His wife claims she has no idea where he is. The DA's getting a search warrant for the house in case she refuses access. Beckert doesn't seem to have any personal friends, so that's not a useful avenue.
We put a watch on his credit cards. So far, no activity. He was seen leaving headquarters around 5:30 the night before last, but we haven't found anyone who saw him after that.
His wife was at some 3-day spa getaway with a couple of friends and claims she has no idea what time he got home that night or whether he came home at all.
He took his car?
Probably. All we know for sure is that it's gone from the headquarters parking lot.
A silence ensued as Gurney pondered the timing of the man's disappearance the night before the incident at the gun club.
Torres spoke first.
It's really pretty amazing.
What is?
How you've been right about everything?
I remember in the very first meeting you came to, your uneasiness with the assumptions everyone was making about the case. It was like you knew instantly there was something wrong with the basic hypothesis. I could see how disturbed Beckert and Turlock were by the issues you were raising. Now we know why.
We still have a long way to go, a lot of open questions.
But that reminds me of something you commented on in the video of the Steele shooting. The red laser dot on the back of Steele's head as he was patrolling the edge of the crowd. You wondered why the dot followed him as long as it did. I think you said it was like 2 minutes?
That's right.
Have you figured it out?
Not yet.
You still feel it's significant?
Yes.
It seems like such a small thing.
Gurney said nothing.
But he was thinking it was the small things that often mattered the most. Especially the ones that didn't seem to make sense.
45. Gurney remained parked in front of the nursery greenhouses after ending his call with Torres. Hoping he wouldn't be spotted by Rob Snook, he leaned back in his seat and tried to clear his mind and sort out his priorities for the rest of the day. Clearing his mind, it turned out, wasn't so easy. Something was bothering him, though he wasn't sure what. Perhaps Madeline's prolonged absence? He always felt odd when she was away from home, and phone conversations didn't really solve the problem. He'd filled her in the previous evening on the gun club discoveries and the Turlock homicide, minus its more grotesque details. He'd cautioned her against saying anything yet to Kim or Heather, adding that he'd be meeting with the DA to review the situation. She'd told him she'd be staying at the inn on the Mercy Medical Campus for at least another 24 hours, at which point various Steele and Loomis relatives were expected to arrive. She'd reminded him to refill the feeders and let the chickens into their fenced run. He'd told her he loved her and missed her, and she'd said the same. What he hadn't mentioned was that someone had taken a shot at him. He told himself at first it was because he didn't want to alarm her with the specter of a possibly ongoing danger. A day later, with the rifle recovered, Turlock dead, and Beckert apparently on the run, he told himself it was because there was no longer any danger, and therefore no urgency in discussing the matter. But he had to admit now, sitting there in front of Snook's greenhouses, that he always found it suspicious when someone offered shifting reasons for the same conclusion. A wise friend once commented that the more reasons someone gave you for their behavior, the less likely any of them was the real reason. Perhaps that was what was bothering him, not so much Madeline's absence as his own evasiveness. He resolved to be more open with her in their next conversation. That simple resolution, as resolutions often do, lightened his mood. He pulled out of the parking lot, focused now on getting home, reviewing the case files, and trying to make sense of the inconsistent details. 25 minutes later, as he was driving up through the low pasture to the house, deciding which file to tackle first, he was surprised to catch a glimpse of Madeline in her straw gardening hat by one of the flower beds. When he got out of the car, he found her kneeling by the bed next to the asparagus patch. She was planting the delphiniums he'd brought home 2 days earlier. She looked pale and exhausted. "Did something happen?" he asked. "I thought you were staying over at the hospital." "The relatives arrived sooner than expected, and I was more worn out than I realized." She laid her trowel down by the flowers, shaking her head. "It's awful. Kim is full of such a terrible anger. At first it was all inside, now it's coming out. Heather is worse, completely shut down, like she's not there at all." Madeline paused. "Is there anything we can tell them about the progress you're making? What you told me on the phone last night sounded huge. It might offer them some kind of relief or distraction." "Not yet." "Why not?" "The current status of an investigation is not something that can be..." She cut him off. "Yes, yes, I know all that. It's just... there's so much misery not knowing anything. I was just hoping..." She picked up her trowel, then put it down again and got to her feet. "Did you have your meeting with Klein?" "That's where I'm coming from." "Did anything get resolved?" "Not really." "What did he want?" "On the surface, my help in wrapping things up. In reality, my silence. The last thing he wants is for the media to find out he fired me 3 days ago for suggesting he had the case all wrong." "What did you tell him?" "That I'd see the case through to the end." She looked confused. "Isn't it essentially over?" "Yes and no. There's a lot of evidence implicating Beckert and Turlock, the things I told you about on the phone, plus a lot more that was discovered overnight and this morning, including the fact that Beckert seems to have disappeared." "Disappeared? Does that make him a fugitive?" "I don't know what language Klein will be using publicly, but it sounds like a reasonable label to me. The new evidence doesn't leave much doubt about his involvement in the playground murders as well as the shootings, so everything's turned around, with Corey, for all practical purposes, exonerated." She laid her trowel down and regarded him closely. "Do I hear a reservation in your voice?" "Just a feeling that I'm still missing something. I'm having trouble matching the risk and brutality of the murders with the supposed reward."
"Doesn't that happen? What about the people who get shot for a pair of sneakers?"
"That happens, but not as part of a well-thought-out plan. Corey is convinced that it's all about Beckert's political future, eliminating people who might create problems for him."
"You think the man is capable of that?"
"He's cold enough, but it still seems out of proportion. There's something in the payoff that I'm not seeing clearly. Maybe I'm asking the wrong questions."
"What do you mean?"
Years ago, in the academy, I attended a class on investigatory techniques. One morning, the instructor asked us, "Why do those deer always run out in front of cars at night?" He got a bunch of answers. Panic, disorientation caused by the headlights, evolutionary dysfunction. Then he pointed out that there was a flawed assumption in the wording of the question itself. How did we know deer always did that at night? Maybe most of them didn't run out in the road, but we didn't realize it, because we could only see the ones that did. And he pointed out that there was a subtle misdirection lurking in the phrase, run out in front of cars, making it sound as though the activity was something clearly dysfunctional. Suppose the question were reworded this way, why do some deer attempt to cross the road when a car is approaching? That way of asking points toward a different set of possible explanations. Since deer are very territorial, perhaps their first instinct in a moment of danger is to head for the part of their territory in which they feel most secure. Perhaps they're just moving instinctively toward a place of safety. Other deer in the immediate area may be running in the opposite direction, away from the road, to get to their places of safety. But those deer are less likely to be seen, especially at night. Anyway, his point was simple. Ask the wrong question, and you never get to the truth. Madeline's impatience was showing. So what question about the case do you think you're getting wrong? I wish I knew. She stared up at him for a long moment. What's your next step? Review the files, look for things that should be done, and do them. And report back to Klein? Eventually. He'd be quite content to have me do nothing so long as I don't rock the boat or make him look bad. Because he has political ambitions of his own? Probably. Until yesterday, that meant hitching a ride with Beckert. I assume now he's seeing his future more as a solo act. Rising to her feet and brushing the soil off her hands, she produced a less than happy smile. I'm going inside. Do you want some lunch? A short while later, as they were silently finishing their meal, it occurred to Gurney that if he didn't tell her now about the severing of the power line and the subsequent gunshot, he probably never would. So he did, describing the event as unthreateningly as he could, as Beckert or Turlock simply taking a shot at the back of the house when he went out to get the generator started. She gave him a look. You don't think he was aiming at you? If he wanted to hit me, he would have kept shooting. How do you know it was Beckert or Turlock? I found the rifle that fired the shot in their cabin the next morning. And now Turlock is dead. Yes. And Beckert is on the run? So it seems. She nodded, frowning. This shooting incident was the night before last? Yes. What took you so long to tell me? He hesitated. I think I was afraid of bringing up memories of the Gillian Perry case. Her expression darkened at the mention of the invasion of their home during that particularly disturbing series of murders. I'm sorry, he said. I should have told you right away. She gave him one of those long looks that made him feel transparent. Then she picked up their plate and carried them to the sink. He suppressed an urge to make more excuses for himself. He went into the den and took out the case materials. With the branding iron and propofol needles now linking Beckert and Turlock directly to the BDA deaths, he opened the consolidated file on Jordan and Tooker. It contained surprisingly little beyond the incident report, notes on the interview with the dog walker who found the bodies, printouts of some of Paul Aziz's photos, the two autopsy reports, an investigatory progress form with little progress recorded beyond a description of Turlock's raid on the Gort brothers' compound and the evidence he supposedly found there. There was also some bare-bones data on the victims. Tooker, according to the file, was a loner with no known family connections nor any personal associations outside the BDA. Jordan was married, but there was no record of any interview being conducted with his wife, beyond a note indicating that she had been informed of his death. It was clear to Gurney that the decision to target the Gorts for the murders of Jordan and Tooker had dramatically narrowed the scope of the investigation, eliminating virtually all activities not directly supportive of that view of the case. The decision had created a yawning information gap that he felt an itch to rectify.
Remembering that the Reverend Coolidge had provided an alibi for Jordan and Tooker after the Steele shooting, and had later spoken highly of them, Gurney thought the pastor might have a phone number for Jordan's wife. He placed a call to Coolidge. As he was leaving a message, the man picked up, his tone professionally warm.
"Good to hear from you, David. How's your investigation going?"
We've made some interesting discoveries, which is why I'm calling you. I want to get in touch with Marcel Jordan's wife. I was hoping you might have a number for her.
Well... Coolidge hesitated. I don't believe Tanya is willing to speak to anyone in law enforcement, which is how she'd view you, regardless of how independent your relationship with officialdom might be.
Not even if she could be helpful in solving her husband's murder, and possibly revealing the complicity of people in law enforcement? There was a pregnant silence.
Are you serious? That's a possibility?
Yes.
Let me get back to you.
It didn't take long. Coolidge called back in less than 10 minutes to inform Gurney that Tanya declined to speak to him on the phone, but that she'd be willing to meet with him at the church. 45 minutes later, Gurney was pulling into the lot of St. Thomas the Apostle. He parked and took the path through the old churchyard. He was almost to the building's back door when he saw her, standing very still among the moss-stained gravestones. A tall, brown-skinned 30-something woman in a plain gray T-shirt and sweatpants, she had the lean body and wiry arms of a long-distance runner. Her dark, suspicious eyes were fixed on him.
"Tanya?"
She didn't answer. "I'm Dave Gurney." Again, she remained silent.
"Would you prefer to talk out here or inside?"
"Maybe I've decided not to speak to you at all."
"Is that true?"
"Suppose it is."
"Then I'll get back in my car and go home."
She cocked her head, first one way, then the other, with no discernible meaning. "We'll talk right here. What did it mean, what you said to the pastor?"
"I told him we've made some discoveries concerning your husband's murder."
"You told him police might have been involved?"
"I said it looked that way."
"What facts do you have?"
"I can't reveal specific evidence, but I suspect that your husband and Virgil Tooker, as well as the two police officers, may all have been killed by the same person."
"Not by the Payne boy or them Gort lunatics?"
"I don't believe so."
He studied her impassive face for some reaction, but saw none. Behind her loomed the marble angel on whose wing Coolidge a few days earlier had extinguished his cigarette. "The man you're calling my husband," she said after a pause, "was really more my ex, though we never got divorced. We were living in the same house for the economies of it, but we were separated in our minds. Man was a fool." Another pause. "What do you want from me?"
"Your help in getting to the truth of what happened."
"How am I supposed to do that?"
"You could start with why you say Marcel was a fool."
"He had a weakness. Women loved him, and he loved them back."
"That's what ended your marriage?"
"It created situations that were a pain to my heart. But I tried to live with the weakness because there was so much strength in him otherwise. Strength and a true desire for justice. Justice for people who have no power. He wanted to stand up for those people. To do what he could to take some of the strife and fear out of their lives. That was his vision for the BDA.
"How did he get along with the other two BDA leaders?"
"Virgil Tooker and Blaze Jackson?"
Gurney nodded.
"Well, I'd have to say that Virgil wasn't really what you'd call a leader. He was just a good man and happened to be close to Marcel. And Marcel pretty much pulled him into that position because he trusted him. The man had no huge talent, no huge fault. He just wanted to do the right thing. That's all Virgil wanted, to be helpful."
Gurney was struck by the echo of Mark Torres's goal as a police officer. "And Blaze Jackson?"
The first sign of emotion appeared on Tanya's face, something hard and bitter. When she spoke, her voice was almost frighteningly calm. "Blaze Lovely Jackson is the devil incarnate.
Ain't nothing that bitch wouldn't do to get what she wants. Blaze is all about Blaze. Fiery talker, loves to be on stage, loves the attention, people looking up at her. Loves to lay it down hard on the corrupt police and stir up the crowd. But all the time she's got her evil eye on what's in it for her, what she can take from someone else.
Was she the reason for your separation from your husband?
My husband was a fool. That was the reason for our separation.
A brief silence fell between them.
Gurney asked if she'd seen Marcel or Virgil at any time in the 48 hours before they were killed.
She shook her head.
He asked if she'd seen or heard anything before or after their murders that might relate to them in any way.
Nothing. Only the fact that Blaze is now the sole leader of the Black Defense Alliance, a position which the bitch surely loves.
She likes being in charge.
Power is what she likes. Likes it way too much.
Gurney sensed the beginning of restlessness in Tanya's body language. He wanted to keep the door open for possible future conversations, so he decided to end this one now.
I appreciate your taking the time to meet with me, Tanya. You've been very open. And what you've told me is quite helpful, thank you.
Don't misunderstand me, I'm not here to do you a favor. You said police could be involved in the shit that went down, and I'd love to see that get proven and them get put in the penitentiary with the brothers waiting for them. That would be a sweetness to my heart. So don't go thinking the wrong way. I live in a divided world, and not on your side of the line.
I understand.
Do you? Do you know why this spot right here is my favorite place in all of White River?
He glanced around the old graveyard.
Tell me.
It's full of dead white people.
46. Gurney's route from St. Thomas the Apostle back toward the interstate put him on the road that bordered Willard Park. As he approached the main entrance, Paul Aziz's photos came to mind, and he decided to take another look at the playground area. The parking lot was nearly full, unsurprising on a balmy spring afternoon. He found a spot, then took the pedestrian path along the edge of the mowed field where the BDA demonstration had taken place. The statue of the colonel had been cordoned off with police line do not cross yellow tape, an apparent effort to keep it from being toppled or defaced before an official decision could be made regarding its fate. Although the rest of the park appeared well populated with sunbathers, frisbee tossers, dog walkers, and young mothers with toddlers, the playground was deserted. Gurney wondered how long it would take for its forbidding aura to fade. A hand-printed sign on the kayak rental shed said, "Closed until further notice." The blackbirds, however, continued to occupy the dense reeds along the edge of the lake. As Gurney approached the swing set, they rose up and began shrieking and swooping over his head. But when he stopped there, they soon lost interest and settled back into the reeds. The UTV tire tracks documented in Aziz's photos were no longer visible, but Gurney remembered where they'd been. He looked once more at the Jungle Gym crossbar with the two shiny spots that his conversation with Aziz had persuaded him were indeed clamp marks. He began running scenarios through his head, picturing the likely steps that would have been taken in bringing the two victims to that point and binding them to the bars. He imagined Jordan and Tooker being persuaded to attend a meeting at some site where they were rendered controllable with a combination of alcohol and midazolam. They were then brought to the cabin, or more likely to the shed behind it. There they would have been heavily sedated with propofol, preparatory to being beaten, stripped, and branded, creating the illusion of a violent racist attack. They would then have been strapped into Beckert's UTV and transported from the cabin via the connecting trail system to the playground. He pictured the UTV emerging from the woods in the pre-dawn darkness, proceeding toward the Jungle Gym, stopping in front of it, a chill mist drifting through the headlight beams. Beckert and Turlock were in the front seat, Jordan and Tooker, naked, anesthetized, close to death, were in the back seat. Behind them in the utility box were coils of rope and a sturdy clamp. He pictured Beckert and Turlock getting out with flashlights, quickly deciding which man would be bound up first, and then what. One option would be for Beckert and Turlock together to lift one of the victims out of the UTV and stand him upright with his back against the bars.
While one of them held the man in place, the other could get the clamp and one of the ropes, tie an end of the rope around the man's neck, loop the rest of it over the bar in back of his head, and hold it in place with the clamp until it could be knotted securely. They could then tie the man's torso and legs to the lower bars to ensure that he remained in a standing position. Meanwhile, a slow, fatal strangulation would likely be occurring. As Gurney thought about it, the process seemed revolting but feasible. Then it dawned on him that there was an easier way, a way that would have required virtually no physical effort. Each victim in turn could have been pulled out of the back of the UTV and dumped on the ground in front of the jungle gym. After one of the ropes had been tied around the victim's chest, the free end could be passed over a bar and tied to the back of the UTV. The UTV could then be driven forward, causing the rope to lift the victim up toward the bar. The clamp could then be employed to hold the rope in place while the end was detached from the UTV, wrapped around the bar and knotted. Finally, the victim could be secured in his grotesque standing position by pulling the rest of the rope tightly around his legs, torso, and, with fatal effect, his neck. That way would definitely be easier. In fact, it would be so easy, it obviated the need for two men, meaning that the double murder could have been carried out by either Beckard or Turlock. It was even possible one had acted without the other's knowledge. If so, Gurney wondered if that might have had something to do with Turlock's murder. After a final look around the playground, as he turned to head back to the parking lot, he noticed he was being watched by one of the dog walkers, a short, muscular man with a gray buzz cut and two large Dobermans. He was standing in the middle of the path about 50 yards away. As Gurney got closer, he could see anger in the man's eyes. With little appetite for confrontation, Gurney stayed toward the edge of the path. "Good-looking dogs," he said pleasantly as he was passing. The man ignored the compliment and gestured toward the playground. "You one of the cops looking into this thing?" Gurney stopped. "That's right. Do you have any information about it?" "Couple of the brothers got what they deserved." "How do you figure that?" "White River used to be a nice place to live. Great place to bring up kids, safe little town, look at it now. Street I live on used to be beautiful. You should see it today. Section 8 housing. Free rent for freeloaders. Next door I got a crazy son of a bitch in a dashiki, like he's actually from Africa. Lives with his two baby mamas. You and I pay for that. And here's the thing. He's got this black rooster and white hens. That's a hostile message. Every year he slaughters the white hens in his backyard where I can see it, chops their heads off. But never the black rooster. What do you call that? What do you call it? What it is, a terroristic threat. That's what you should be worried about. Do you want to make a complaint?" "That's what I'm doing, right here, right now." "To make a formal complaint, you need to visit police headquarters and fill out..." The man interrupted with a disgusted wave of his hand. "Waste of time, everybody knows that." He turned away abruptly, gave a tug on the dog's leashes, and strode out into the field, muttering obscenities. Gurney proceeded along the path to his car, reminded once more of the fear and loathing in the melting pot of America. Once he was sitting in the outback, it occurred to him that he should pass along to Mark Torres the fact that the murders of Jordan and Tooker could have been managed by one person. He placed the call. As usual, Torres picked up quickly and sounded eager to hear whatever Gurney had to say. He explained his one-man theory. Torres was quiet for a moment. "Do you think this should change our focus?" "For now, we just need to keep the possibility in mind and see how it fits with whatever else we learn. Speaking of which, have we found out if Beckard and Turlock have alibis for the night of the Jordan Tooker murders or the night of the sniper shootings?" "So far, no one we've spoken to recalls being with them on those occasions, but that's not surprising. They didn't exactly hang out with the troops. Turlock reported only to Beckard, and Beckard reports only to the mayor. You met Duane Shucker, so you can imagine there wasn't much actual reporting going on there. Beckard's wife's been no help. Apparently has a busy social life, isn't home much, and doesn't keep tabs on her husband. As for Turlock, he lives alone. Nearest neighbor is a mile away and claims to know nothing about him.
The outback was getting hot in the afternoon sun in the unshaded parking area, and Gurney opened the windows. The Jordan Tooker file shows no real interviews after the murders other than a couple of cryptic notations about tips from unnamed informants and a brief statement from the guy who found the bodies. Am I missing something?
Not as far as I know.
Remember, I had the case for less than a day. Once Turlock took it over, it was all about the Gorts.
None of Jordan's or Tooker's associates were interviewed?
The only associates either of them seemed to have were the BDA members who were arrested in the raid on their headquarters. With charges pending, they were advised by counsel not to make any statements at all to the police.
What about Jordan's wife?
She refused to talk to Turlock.
Torres paused.
Some people here see us as an occupying army.
Actually, I spoke to her today.
How'd you manage that?
I told her I thought that someone in law enforcement might go down for the killing. She liked that idea.
I bet. Did she say anything useful?
She made it pretty clear that Marcel had gotten sexually involved with Blaze Jackson, and that Blaze Jackson is a nasty piece of work.
Wait. Hold on a second.
Gurney could hear an indistinct conversation in the background. When Torres got back on the line, he sounded upbeat.
That was Shelby Towns. She said that a pair of boots found in the cabin are a perfect tread match for the boot prints found on the stairs in the Poulter Street house.
Are they Turlock's or Beckert's? Or could she tell?
Turlock's, she could tell by the size.
Looks like he was the Loomis shooter, so this is coming together in a way that...
Sorry, hold on again.
After another background conversation, Torres returned.
Shelby says that Corey Payne's fingerprints are on all those cartridges you found with the rifle.
That's consistent with Corey's story of helping his father with the reloading process. Any other news?
Just that the DA will be appearing this evening on Newsbreakers.
What's that?
It's the lead-in program to Ram's Battleground tonight. Should be interesting to watch Klein explaining how his godlike hero turned into a devil overnight.
Gurney agreed. Since Klein couldn't keep the media at bay forever, he'd evidently decided to jump in with both feet in a desperate effort to shape the narrative.
47.
Just before 6 p.m., Gurney opened his laptop and went to the RAM website. As it was loading, something caught his eye through the window next to his desk, a spot of fuchsia moving along the top of the high pasture. He realized it was Madeline in her bright windbreaker mowing the grass swath that separated the pasture from the woods. He watched as she turned the riding mower onto a path that led down to the house. Then he went to the live stream page and clicked on View Now. A moment later, the screen was filled with bright blue words flashing against a black background. Ram Newsbreakers, Special Early Edition, What You Need to Know Now. The words exploded into pieces. Then the pieces flew back together to form new words. The hunter becomes the hunted in stunning reversal. Those words in turn exploded, only to be immediately reconstituted in another headline. Top cop, now prime suspect, in sensational White River murders. On a final drumbeat, the scene switched to a shot of a male and female news team making a show of jotting down last-minute notes at their RAM TV news desk. The female member was the first to put down her pen and look directly into the camera.
Good evening. I'm Stacy Kilbrick.
Gurney noted that her default expression of serious professional concern had been ratcheted up into a grim intensity. He was momentarily distracted by the ringing of his phone. He saw that it was Thrasher, and he let it go to voicemail. The male on the screen put down his pen. Neat and petulant, he looked like a flight attendant with a grievance.
Good evening, I'm Rory Kronk. We have a big story for you tonight, a Newsbreakers exclusive report on the mind-boggling developments in White River, New York. Lay out the facts for our viewers, Stacy.
As you were saying, Rory, those facts are nothing short of amazing. The hunter has become the hunted. Disturbing new evidence is linking Del Beckert, former White River police chief and nationally known law and order advocate, to four shocking murders that his own department was investigating. And now it appears that he's taken off for parts unknown under a heavy cloud of suspicion.
She turned toward Kronk.
We've covered our share of wild stories over the years, Rory, but I've never seen the likes of this, have you?
Never, Stacy.
and the vanishing chief is just part of it. The deputy chief we've just learned has turned up dead. And we're talking about the kind of grisly murder that's usually reserved for horror movies.
Kilbrick produced a theatrical look of revulsion.
Apart from the gory details, the real shocker to me is the way the whole case has been flipped upside down. Don't you agree?
Totally.
I understand a lot of the credit goes to the district attorney and to a very special homicide detective attached to his department.
That's absolutely true. In fact, just before this program, I had a revealing conversation with D.A. Klein.
Great, Rory. Let's run that tape right now.
Gurney heard the side door out by the mudroom open and close. A minute later, Madeline came into the den. She peered at his laptop screen.
What are you watching?
Live interview with Klein.
She pulled a chair over and sat down. The scene on the screen had shifted to a bare-bones interview setting. Klein and Kronk were sitting in chairs facing each other with a bookcase in the background. Klein appeared to have just gotten a haircut. Kronk was leaning forward in the middle of a sentence. A word that's on everyone's mind. Shocker. Top cop becomes top suspect. And his son, who was your top suspect, has essentially been declared innocent. Our heads are spinning. Let me ask you the obvious question. If your view of the case today is right, how could you have been so wrong yesterday?
Klein's reaction was a pained smile.
That sounds like a simple question, Rory, but the reality isn't simple at all. You have to remember that the earlier case hypothesis that zeroed in on Corey Payne for the sniper shootings and the Gort twins for the playground murders was a willful deception created by our current suspect. From the very beginning, there was a concerted effort by WRPD leadership to mislead my office. This is not a matter of our misreading the case. What we're dealing with is a vicious and devious betrayal of the public trust by a man whose sworn duty it was to treat that trust as sacred.
You make it sound like an act of real treachery.
I see it as a form of moral decay.
How deep in the department might that decay go?
That's something we're actively looking into.
Your resources must be stretched pretty thin.
With so many unanswered questions about these terrible crimes and who's trustworthy and who's not to mention the ongoing racial unrest in parts of White River, where's the necessary manpower coming from?
Klein moved uncomfortably in his chair.
The situation is actually well in hand.
Are there any plans to bring in the state police or the FBI, considering the possible hate crime angle?
Not at this time.
So you're saying you have all the resources you need?
I'm not just saying it, Rory. I know it for a fact.
You sound amazingly confident, considering what you're facing. 4 sensational murders. 5 now, counting the deputy chief. Wouldn't it make sense to bring in the kind of expertise that the state police could offer?
With all due respect, sir, yours is a rural county in which the typical crimes are drunk driving, minor drug offenses, and disturbing the peace. What you're facing now is infinitely more complicated. Doesn't that worry you?
Klein took a deep breath.
Normally, we don't reveal staffing details, Rory. But for the sake of public confidence, I want to put this expertise issue to rest. The fact is, our level of investigatory sophistication right now is unsurpassed. A key member of my current team happens to be Dave Gurney, the highly decorated detective who holds the record for the largest number of cleared homicide cases in the history of the New York City Police Department. I'm talking about close to 100 homicides solved personally by this man, including famous serial murder cases. It's through his relentless questioning and his insights that we've arrived at our current understanding of the situation in White River. You asked why I wasn't bringing in state police investigators. The fact is, Dave Gurney has given advanced seminars on homicide investigation at the State Police Academy. So, in the matter of expertise, we take a back seat to no one. We have the best there is.
That's fascinating news. I'm impressed.
Klein said nothing.
I appreciate that your time is limited, sir, and I know you have a final message you want to leave with our viewers.
Yes, I do.
He gazed sternly into the camera.
Our top priority right now is locating Del Beckert.
A phone number appeared at the bottom of the screen. Klein continued.
If you know anything about his whereabouts, or if you know anyone who does,
Please call this number. He may be driving a black Dodge Durango. New York plate number CBIIWRPD. The screen displayed the plate number, a photograph of